ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on ABC Radio National, where we're still doing what we've done for nearly 40 years, examining what really matters in this changing world.
It's a power grab in advance.
And it felt fugitive, an alternative.
And people were willing to take risks.
Hear it now with four brand new episodes each week on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, where your stories shape the national conversation. Did you know it is illegal to feed or adopt a stray cat in some parts of Australia? In Queensland, at least, you can face penalties for caring for a stray as part of the state's biosecurity laws to protect native wildlife. We could be about to see changes to the regulations. So how do we strike the balance between showing compassion to an individual animal in need and preserving our fragile ecosystem? Plus, a world of shopping where price tags are made just for you, depending on how much the algorithm reckons you'd be willing to pay. It's called personalised pricing, and it might already be happening. It's all coming up here on ABC Radio National. But first, across the country, there are about 45,000 children in out-of-home care. About 8,000 are in a foster home. These kids rely on foster carers who open up their homes, who feed and clothe them, provide emotional support, and often help them stay connected to their birth families. But in Victoria, some foster carers are reporting sudden reductions in their allowances for looking after kids with high-level needs. At the moment, that's an issue that seems to be limited to Victoria, but it highlights the ongoing challenges around the country when it comes to finding foster carers for children who need safety and stability. And the number of foster care families have been dropping across all states and territories over the last 5 years. Cost of living pressures, low carer allowances, carers feeling undervalued, it all adds up to a system that's letting down carers and vulnerable children. So, what needs to change? You're about to hear from a few people within the system, but I also want to hear from you. Are you a foster carer? What has your experience been? Maybe you've left the system. And if so, what factors led you to leave? Samantha Hoger is Chief Executive of the Foster Care Association of Victoria and is with me now. Samantha, welcome.
Thank you, Tegan. Thank you for having me.
So, Samantha, a couple of months ago, your group started getting calls from foster carers. What were they telling you?
Over the last few months, Tegan, we've been, receiving a growing number of calls and anecdotally hearing from our carers who are experiencing a reduction in their care allowance level, often resulting in a reduction from a higher care allowance level, like the child was assessed to have high level needs, down to basic one care level payment. And the care allowance, just for your listeners, is a financial contribution towards the day-to-day costs incurred while providing care for a child or young person.
And so you need to remember, complex needs maybe need a bit more funding.
Absolutely. We've got five categories here in Victoria, and the higher levels, the level four and five, are meant to reflect, you know, the additional time, experience, expense involved in supporting a child with greater behavioural, emotional, medical, developmental challenges. You know, at the higher level, those children present often with, you know, several physical, psychological issues. They require extensive structure, strong routine, a lot of therapeutic support to undertake daily activities, you know, things like speech therapy, occupational therapy, numerous paediatric appointments. And what's clear is that those carers at that level are providing, you know, 24/7, round-the-clock care.
Do you have a sense of how many families are affected?
Well, our hotline has been receiving, you know, a number of calls from carers who have experienced this situation. It'd be fair to say that we're unlikely to be aware of all of them. Just one carer actually in this situation is too many. Mm. And the fact that level one payments in Victoria are issued at all is just widely insufficient. You know, in Victoria we have the lowest level one care allowance in Australia, which is nowhere, you know, near meeting the true costs of caring for a child, let alone the costs of, you know, raising a child in care that usually you know, come from a trauma background and, you know, have very complex needs. So that shortfall places enormous financial pressure on our carers. And, you know, it really is driving many to leave the system altogether. Our household, carer households are being forced to shoulder costs that, you know, they really can't afford. And the result, you know, we have here in Victoria, crisis of care attrition that really threatens the stability of our foster care system.
It's not just this one issue. You sort of say you've been hearing these calls over the last few months, but it sounds like it's sort of one contributor to a bigger trend that you've been observing.
Yes, look, definitely. Like I was saying, you know, in Victoria, our care allowance is just not keeping pace with inflation. Household inflation has been up around 6-7% in recent years. Our care allowance here has only increased by 2-2.5%. with no increase, you know, in the true value of our allowance since 2016, when back then it was only increased by $20. That was 8 years ago. So here carers are really doing it tough, and it's not fair on our, you know, volunteers. The financial burden's making it, you know, for foster carers an increasingly unsustainable option. And I should just say that our basic care allowance is, you know, approximately $31 a day, and that's to cover everything from recreational, educational, health, therapeutic and daily living expenses, like, you know, providing food, nappies, formula, clothing, transportation. It's far below what's needed. And it's actually declined, you know, in real value by approximately $25. But in contrast, the New South Wales government has recently, you know, recognised the need to increase their care allowance, and they've just, from the 1st of January, there'll be a 20% increase for carers there. And the stark contrast, for example, is that you'll have a child living in New South Wales, a 14-year-old child, and a 14-year-old child here. There's a difference of $400 per fortnight in that care allowance to what our Victorian carer would receive. Or if they're caring for a 5-year-old child, for example, it is an extra $312 a fortnight. So we're talking, you know, significant. Well, Victoria's significantly behind any other state, and at the same time, you know, we're not receiving, you know, the same number of children are entering care, and the same low care allowance, which really directly correlates to, in Victoria, the alarming and serious decline in foster care numbers available. In Victoria, for example, over the last 4 years, we've had a net loss of 1,300 carer households. Mm. And that's households, not individuals. Most households have, you know, at least two carers there. So we're losing more good carers than we are recruiting. And, you know, it is, like I said, in stark contrast with our neighbouring states and really across the nation, who have relatively, you know, stable number of carers.
Samantha, as you say, each state sort of has its own department that handles child protection, like foster care. We did reach out to the Victorian government. A spokesperson told us that foster and kinship carers do an outstanding job supporting children who cannot live safely with their immediate family, and we value the work that they do. Care allowance levels vary based on age and needs of a child and can be reassessed as a child's needs changed. It's not related to budget, says this statement. There has been no change, the spokesperson said, in the care allowance policy. Well, just to cast the net a bit wider across the country, Renee Lee is also with me. She's the CEO of Adopt Change and a member of the National Foster and Kinship Care Collective. Renee, the challenges that we're hearing Samantha describe here, are they being felt Australia-wide?
Morning, Tegan. Look, I think if we look at the bottom line of how many children in the care system aren't in a family-based home, so they're not with foster carers or kinship carers, that's at around 10%, so around 4,800 children, which really demonstrates the shortage of home-based care. So we're seeing people who are no longer staying in the care system as a foster carer, and we're not seeing the same number of entries. So it certainly is a nationwide felt problem.
I have a text here, Renee. One person says, why do First Nations people who are kinship carers get paid even less than foster carers? Refer to the Yuruk testimonies.
Look, there's There's carer payments, as Samantha was talking about before, in each state. So as well as the foster carers that you mentioned, in terms of the 8,000, 45% of the carers are kinship or relative carers. And so it will depend based on the jurisdiction that a carer is based in. And we also see that there are informal carers, particularly in this space where a relative will take in a child and they're not part of the authorised system, and they are certainly very unsupported financially.
We heard Samantha say before just the huge discrepancy between what a carer in Victoria would be getting for a child of a certain age versus the same situation but in New South Wales. Is it appropriate that it varies so dramatically across the country?
No, they're the same children needing the same level of care, and the same amazing carers who have the same cost of living challenges. So to be a carer, you need space in your home and the ability to care for a child and take time when needed to take them to appointments, etc. So it really is a question of viability. Carers, both foster and kinship carers, are volunteers, and the amount is quite small in terms of going towards the child's needs and caring for them. So really, in New South Wales, the reason there's been an increase is around the advocacy and the recognition that carers need the allowance increase just to be able to afford the role that they have taken on. So really, from a national perspective, this needs to be taken up elsewhere as well, because it has been recognised in New South Wales. It needs to be recognised across Australia.
What happens if the number of foster carers gets so low that what happens to those children?
Unfortunately, they're quite terrible outcomes. So we see with the 10%, so around 4,800 kids end up in a residential group setting, so essentially a group home with shift workers where children grow up instead of being placed with a family and having that sense of normality. And then a step down from that is being placed in a motel or caravan park with shift workers, which really is just opening up an additional potential for terrible things for that child. So it really is important that we have enough carers. The other, I guess, factor around that is looking at what the cost of that type of care is. So if you place a child in those non-family-based home settings, it actually costs the government upwards of $500,000 per child per year, sometimes $1 million per year. So really, when you compare that to, let's just say, around $15,000 a year put towards caring for a child in a home, there's a huge disparity, and the outcomes for a child that misses out on the family-based home are pretty damning.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm speaking with Renee Lee, who's the CEO of Adopt Change and a member of the National Foster and Kinship Care Collective. You also have been hearing from Samantha Hoger, who's the Chief Executive of the Foster Care Association of Victoria, talking about the fact that in Victoria, at least, there are reports of people getting less money for kids with high care needs, which is really impacting on their ability to provide good quality foster care, people exiting the system. And I'm asking for your stories. If you have been part of the foster care system, I'd love to know your story. I'd love to know if you have ideas on how it could be fixed. One text says, "I'm a foster carer, worse than the allowance. The system is totally broken and the support for children is dropping. There's little continuity because they're so stretched and the additional burden lands on those who care." Well, Emma is a foster carer in Brisbane. She and her husband have three kids and then also have been foster carers too. Emma, what got you interested in being a foster carer to start with?
Good morning, Keegan. I think, like a lot of people, we just wanted to be part of society. We thought it's something that we'd do when the kids were older. And then I thought, hang on, why wait? You know, like at the time we had a 3, 5, and 7-year-old, and you're totally in the throes of parenting. You're doing it all. You know, and when you've got three kids, what's another? So I guess we thought, you know, why wait? Let's do it now. We also thought it would be an amazing experience for our children, you know, just to have that empathy for others, to be kind and just be accepting of different walks of life. So, you know, I think it was just a no-brainer for us to get into, for sure.
So you've gone in, like, no one sort of goes into foster care and going, oh, I think this is going to be really easy. Like, I think people know that it's going to be a challenge, but was it the sort of challenge you were expecting?
It's been a mind-blowing experience, actually. I think nothing could have prepared us for what we were essentially getting ourselves into. I think you just have a false sense of security that you're going to be making a positive difference and it's going to be an easy road. And I think just, you know, what we hear from carers and what we hear about the system, that yes, it's very broken. The support is very minimal. And you're handed our most vulnerable kids in society. And there's so much red tape, you know. It's not as if you can just parent them the way that you'd like to, you know, parent them. Or there's just so many factors that just keep popping up. And I think it's really hard to sometimes realise that you're doing it for the right reasons, because you're just fighting against a broken system.
Do you mind, do you have an example you can give on the sort of red tape that you've faced?
I think family connection is a massive one, especially when you're dealing with the smaller, you know, the tiny people in our society that are in care, you know, talking about the newborns and the babies. And, you know, I think the department is so overloaded and so overwhelmed with their caseloads that reunification is always going to be the key, which is absolutely fantastic. But all the restraints of wanting to keep babies connected to their families, but not having the resources to do it. So, you know, I think taking that time out of your own day and out of your own family's, you know, week is massive, because you feel responsible for, okay, the department can't facilitate contact this week because they're overloaded. I can do it three times. So, you know, I think that you've got all this moral responsibility that you want to continuously do the right thing, but it's either all put onto you, or it's left that the department will say, oh, actually, we can't do three times a week, we can only do one. And then you've got a mother with a newborn baby that, you know, it's out of her control that she can't have the child with her. But I feel like as society, we also need to support that, which the department lacks ginormously, you know, emotionally, physically, financially, all those things that we need as carers to actually keep these kids connected. It's just not happening.
So Emma, you've had a number of babies in and out of your house over the 5 years you've been a foster carer. You don't have anyone with you at the moment, and you're really weighing up whether this is something you can continue to offer.
We are, definitely. Our care renewal is up in 3 months' time. So, you know, I think over the last 5 years, we've had some beautiful cases. We've had some cases that are just, you know, you want to bash your head against a brick wall. You feel unappreciated. You feel used. There's no continuity within the department and the people that you deal with. So, you know, you feel like no one knows these kids. And as carers, you become the advocate for them and you become their voices, but your voice is not heard. Your opinion is irrelevant. So, you know, I feel like you're fighting a broken system. And I don't know if it's easier to walk away from that, or I don't know if it's, you know, something that you just want to keep picking at. And I believe you can't complain about a situation if you're not prepared to change it. So, you know, as carers, we're sitting there going, look, emotionally and morally, we really want to do this. But, you know, the emotional toll that it has on yourself and also your kids. And I think that when you've got your own children and you do become a carer, your children are, you know, they're undervalued, they're overlooked, and they are such an important part of the system, because they are the ones that are showing these kids like some normality in society. They're the ones that, you know, share their home, they open up their rooms, they, you know, share their toys, they play games with them. They, you know, they're such a huge part, and the department, I don't know, they're so unappreciative, and I think they, you know, they could do better in the support for families. So, you know, I think that we've just experienced so many times that it's like our kids are left in emotional, you know, that emotionally that they don't cope when placements move on and there's no support for them. So I think the bigger picture is not only as adults wanting to make that difference, but the impact that it has on your family and, you know, whether or not time will fix that, you know, have a year off and then go back to it. But, you know, I don't know. It's a tricky one, Tegan.
Yeah. We're talking about foster care this morning here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National about the various challenges that foster families face to remain in the system, the fact that the attrition rate is really high. And I'm asking you for your stories of fostering. A text here: we have been privileged to share our love and home with beautiful children as foster carers, but it has left us broken and we see it breaking many children in care. The foster care agency we work with operates like a business with a lack of child and family focus. Their casework staff are lovely but underqualified, overworked, and there's constant turnover. This means inconsistent support for us and, most importantly, for the children. The text continues, we feel so conflicted being part of the foster care system when we see that it doesn't adequately care for children, families and carers. We don't want to abandon children we love. This texter finishes, I strongly discourage anyone from being a foster carer. It's heartbreaking and harrowing. Renee, hearing someone who's obviously been part of this system actively discouraging it, how does that land for you?
Look, unfortunately, it's not a surprise. We've heard from people in some of the surveys that we've run around that it's not something that they'd recommend. The numbers for that are too high, but not surprising considering the experience. And it's typically not around their experience of caring for the child. It's their experience with being part of the system, their frustrations with that, not being given the respect and communication and transparency that they need so that they can really care for the child in their home. So what we advocate for is that there is much better support for those who are caring for Australia's most vulnerable children, and so that they are respected for the huge role that they play, and that they're able to speak positively about the experience, which is globally recognised as the best way to find new carer homes as well, is they're talking about what that experience of care has been and attracting other people in.
What does best practice look like? How could we make this system more carer and child friendly in Australia?
Look, when we see that it works, it is around respect for the carer and making sure that they are well supported. So the role needs to be first and foremost viable. So we need to ensure that there is adequate funding for a carer to be able to sustain that role. One of the other biggest items is that often children in the care system have an experience of trauma and they need therapeutic care to heal from what they have been through. And too many of the children don't have access to that care, not readily. And carers will often be advocating for that and they need access to that medical and therapeutic support swiftly. It is the cost of caring for a child that has had that background, so it needs to be recognised as a priority. For carers to be listened to in terms of what their needs are, to be treated as part of the team of people and actually the ones that are there 24/7 for our kids and teens in this space. So they need to be treated as such and really listened to.
Renee, if someone's listening to this conversation and still, in spite of having their eyes open maybe to the challenges, does want to be a foster carer, what's your advice?
Look, the organisations in each state and territory vary, so people are quite welcome to have a look at our website or the websites in their state and territory to find out information and to start that conversation. It's not typically an instant decision. It can take some time to think through and figure out if it's right for you. But I think as with many of the carers, it's people that have a heart for kids that do this despite the system and despite their experience. You know, if this is the experience for carers, we can only imagine how much worse that is for children that don't have their voice and that are subject to whether it's a positive experience or a negative in the system. So there's a lot of carers that will step up, and if people are willing to do that and to take on that role, it's really something that, you know, we do need to hear from more people. And there's organisations like ours and Samantha's who support carers through that process.
Well, thank you all so much for sharing your stories with me today. Renee Lee is CEO of Adopt Change, a member of the National Foster and Kinship Care Collective. You also heard from Samantha Hogar, Chief Executive of the Foster Care Association of Victoria, and Emma, a foster carer. And thank you for your texts as well. Amy says, I'm a foster carer in Victoria. I'm also completing my PhD on ways to support care well-being and role satisfaction. We absolutely love our role, but there are so many pressures and challenges that we face. Most of the challenges are systemic. We've had the Department of Families, Fairness and Housing refuse funding for paediatric appointments. Amy says, funding for carers is needed, but also for staff and training for staff to improve support provision is also a significant need. A different text says, despite the challenges, I would recommend it. There are lots of different ways to be a foster carer, and the difference you can make is invaluable. Well, stick with me here on Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Coming up next, in some parts of Australia, it is illegal to feed or rehome stray cats. The regulations may be changing soon, but how do we strike a balance between compassion to a living creature and preserving our ecosystem? On ABC Radio National,
we examine the forces that shape how we live
and who we have become.
Health services fail Australians.
Governor of the Reserve Bank, Michelle Bullock.
From the economy
to the big ideas.
From fearless debates
to the events that timestamp our lives.
A political eruption across the United States,
Russia,
China, and they have veto.
Go deep.
To challenge,
to question,
and explore our complex world.
ABC Radio National. Imagine you spot a stray kitten. It looks hungry, it's dishevelled, it's obviously homeless. Do you decide to offer it some food or maybe give it somewhere to stay for a bit? Well, depending on where you live in Australia, especially if you live in Queensland, that little act of kindness could land you in hot water because that state's laws treat unowned cats as restricted matter. Feeding or adopting them could see you face penalties in a bid to protect our native wildlife. But a review into Queensland's biosecurity regulations, which closes today, has let people have their say on whether there should be changes. Tell me what you think. Have you ever taken in a stray animal? I'd love to hear your story. You will hear from a wildlife preservation advocate in just a moment, but first, someone who has been outspoken for change is Emeritus Professor Jackie Rand, who's the Executive Director of the Australian Pet Welfare Foundation. Jackie, do you think that people would be surprised to know about this law in Queensland?
Yes, Tegan. Many people are not aware that you cannot feed or adopt an unowned cat. And there's a number of issues with the legislation. Firstly, in urban areas, you can't reliably distinguish from an unidentified owned cat that's either lost or wandering, and an unowned restricted matter cat. And that's because it's a socioeconomic problem. Most free-roaming cats are in disadvantaged areas where income in households, there can be 30% of households living on less than $800 a week. So how do they afford desexing costs for a female cat? And so you've got kittens that are born, they become strays or go into shelters. So one of the problems is that quite a lot of owned cats in these low socioeconomic areas are not microchipped and they don't have a collar. So you can't reliably distinguish what's restricted matter, which has to be killed, and a owned, unidentified wandering cat.
So it's almost like cats are paying the penalty for the fact that the owner or the owner of perhaps the parent of this cat wasn't able to afford desexing?
Yes, but it's not just those people. It's also the veterinarians who, in the end, are tasked with killing those cats that are not adoptable, because the law mandates that they need to be trapped. And if when they come into shelters, of course, shelters try and do best to rehome them. But when there's large numbers coming in, you simply cannot rehome all the timid and shy cats. And as a veterinarian, I can tell you it has a terrible effect on your mental health. And I had to kill healthy animals that were not adopted. And I still remember that from 40 years ago. So, and quotes from veterinarians or senior shelter vet, I've seen so many people's lives damaged by having to kill a never-ending stream of kittens and cats.
Jackie, do we have a sense of how many animals we're talking about here?
Yes. Well, we know about 50,000 cats are killed around Australia each year, most of them are young and healthy. And research we've done in Queensland shows at least 3% of adults are feeding daily a cat they don't perceive they own. And they're feeding an average of 1.5 cats. And at the moment, we are removing about 10% of the free roaming cat population annually. But in a city of 1 million people, based on that 3% of adults, there's about 18,000 female cats producing an average of 5 kittens a year, which is 90,000 kittens. So, you know, what we're doing at the moment is not protecting wildlife. It's not improving social amenity, reducing fighting, peeing, pooing. And it's not actually improving biosecurity, which is really a shame. And modelling shows that we have to kill 30 to 50% of the free roaming cats every 6 months, which is just not achievable. For that city of 1 million, you'd have to kill 27,000 cats in the first year, which would be probably over $15 million to trap them, hold them for the minimum hold period, and then kill them.
So also with me. Also with me is Dr. John Tracy from the Wildlife Preservation Society of Queensland. John, we're looking at, tell me how you perceive this issue of stray and feral cats in Queensland.
Well, Australia's wildlife is unique. More than 80% of our mammals, reptiles, frogs are found nowhere else. So they need our help. And cats are a significant threat to wildlife.
So we're hearing Jackie talking about the numbers of cats around, the current regulations, at least in Queensland. I know that this is a national problem. Is the current approach of basically rounding up and euthanising stray cats the best way to go in terms of what you've seen?
Well, I think there's the right balance between compassion for cats and protecting our wildlife. I think that's what we need. But certainly, you know, I think cats need to be kept inside or in a cat run. We do need to protect our wildlife, our threatened species, and cats are a significant threatening process for over 200 threatened species, so they are a significant threat.
Here on ABC Radio National, you're listening to Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm with Dr. John Tracy from the Wildlife Preservation Society of Queensland and Dr. Jackie Rand, who's the chief scientist at the Australian Pet Welfare Foundation. And I'm asking for your stories about whether you've ever taken in a stray, because we're talking about the balance between the way we regulate stray cats in at some parts of Australia, at least the state of Queensland, where it's actually technically illegal to feed or take in a stray cat. One text says, would it not be better to legislate that owners are required to keep cats indoors at night? Many cats which are rehomed are desexed. Assistance with desexing is much less costly than legislating. Queensland legislators are perhaps in need of urgent assistance. This is tragic. And Jen in Ballarat says the impact of cats on wildlife is the primary issue, sad as it is for cats and horrible for vets. But ask the rescuers and vets responding to wildlife mauled and mangled by cats. Well, Jackie, I'd love to put that first text to you, this idea of what legislation might be more effective than what we've currently got. What does the evidence show us is actually the most effective way of reducing the number of stray cats around?
Tegan, the most important thing is to differentiate the impacts of pet cats in urban areas and truly feral cats, which we know are very threatening to our wildlife. But truly feral cats, and this is what needs to happen with the legislation, is to distinguish those. So we need to change the legislation so that restricted matter cats or feral cats are defined as cats that live remote from humans. They don't get food or shelter from humans. And one of the things that would be easiest to use is something like, you know, there's a high probability it's feral if it's more than 2 kilometres from human habitation. And those cats do have a significant negative effect. But the ones in urban areas, despite the calculations that are theoretical calculations about how many birds and how many mammals pet cats kill, people don't realise that they're predominantly based on non-peer-reviewed data collected 30 to 40 years ago. And in fact, when you look at population studies of mammals and birds, there is no evidence that cats in urban areas have a significant effect on populations. Yes, they do predate, but at a population effect, they're not impacting them. But guess what it is? It's us. It's habitat destruction. It's so density of housing, quality of habitat, and the distance from bushland are the factors. And if you look at why is the Wildlife Information and Rescue Service in New South Wales estimated only 3% of the wildlife they rescue are due to cat attacks.
John, data that Jackie's just referenced sit with your understanding of the data?
Yeah, well, I think the information I've got suggests that wherever you are, where the cats are, whether they're feral or your pet cat, that has a significant impact on wildlife. And we see that all the time, you know, in our trail cameras. We know that 27 species have gone extinct because of cat predation. So there's good evidence there that actually shows that cats are a significant threatening process. They're not the only one. So I agree, habitat loss is a major threat to our wildlife. But predation by cats is also a significant threat that we do need to manage. And whether they're feral or pet or free roaming, we do need to consider the impact that they are having every day on our wildlife.
John, what's the appropriate regulations that are needed here?
So I think the best thing for both wildlife and for cats in terms of, you know, keeping them safe is to keep them indoors, have them registered, you know, have them vaccinated, keep them inside. That's going to keep them safe and it's going to keep our wildlife safe.
So Jackie, the reason we're talking about this today is because regulations in Queensland are they're open for consultation. That consultation process closes today. What are you hoping comes out of that?
That the Act is amended to recognise that only feral cats are restricted matter, and I absolutely agree that they are associated with loss of native wildlife. But those cats live and reproduce remotely from humans. They don't get food or shelter from humans, and they should be listed as restricted matter because, sadly, under the Act at the moment, it's actually a barrier to improving biosecurity. And the most stark example is farm cats, working cats around farm buildings. Farmers are not allowed to desex them and feed them unless they take ownership. And they've got an average of 26 cats. But that's proven, desexing and feeding is proven to reduce the risk of toxoplasmosis in our production animals. And people don't realise that 32% of mutton have toxoplasmosis cysts in their flesh, and if it's not cooked to adequate temperatures, then it's a real risk to women who are pregnant. And so the Biosecurity Act is actually a barrier to improving biosecurity.
Yeah, toxoplasmosis transmitted through cat feces. I think anyone who's been near a pregnancy knows about the risk associated with that. Well, Jackie, John, thank you both so much. A really interesting text says, stray kittens at my work site, Camden Council has a desexing program where if it's a stray, the owner only pays around $50 for desexing and the council pays the rest. Sure helps in reducing stray cat numbers in the long run. Another says it's not just feral cats which kill birds and lizards. And a third text says habitat destruction definitely has such a huge impact on wildlife. It's easy to blame cats. a live one here. Dr. John Tracy is with the Wildlife Preservation Society of Queensland, and you also heard from Dr. Jackie Rand, Emeritus Professor at the University of Queensland and Chief Scientist with the Australian Pet Welfare Association. Well, coming up, the idea of price tags that are tailored just for you sounds great, doesn't it?
In Canada, you see his work everywhere. An original by Norval Morrison. Priceless. But
it became clear that there were more and more fakes.
A story that impacts Indigenous artists around the world.
How has nobody ever looked into this?
Forgeries, fakes, and fortunes to be made. An art fraud of epic proportions.
I either have to let this go or try to find out what the truth is.
Search for the Forged podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This happens to me all the time. Tell me if it's the same for you. I will be shopping online, absentmindedly click add to cart and then abandon that cart because that's how I shop online. Anyway, over the next couple of days, I'm getting ads and emails offering me discounts, competitors matching the price for those very things I barely remember adding to my cart in the first place. And whether or not I go back and buy it, it is kind of eerie knowing that the internet is watching you, tracking your movements. We know that businesses sometimes change the price of products due to demand. I'm thinking about rideshare prices on a Friday night or booking an airline or a ticket or a concert ticket. They surge right as they go on sale. But there is a new type of pricing that is even more targeted. It's called personalized pricing, a price set just for you based on how much the algorithm thinks you're willing to pay because of your own distinct internet trail. So, how do you know if it's happening to you or if there's anything you can do about it? And I also would love to know where you stand on this. Would you like a company to know exactly when to offer you a discount? Or is it creepy surveillance capitalism on another level? With me is Associate Professor Meg Elkins. She's a behavioural economist at RMIT. Meg, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you so much, Tegan. Can I confess something?
Yes.
I become an associate professor in January. But thank you. You're the first person that's ever called me that.
Well, congratulations in advance and welcome to the Associate Professor Club, not that I'm part of it. Tell me about personalised pricing. What is this?
Personalised pricing is, in a way, for an economist, it's perfect price discrimination. So you're charging the maximum amount someone is willing to pay, and it charges for the same product, it charges a different price for that same product or service based on that individual data of that specific customer. So this could be based on the browsing history, their purchase patterns, even the location comes into account here. So it's very much based on your personal characteristics. Very different to dynamic pricing though.
Okay, remind us what dynamic pricing is.
So you've touched on it a little bit in the introduction. So this is what we call surge pricing, where prices go up based on demand. So this is very much as you're getting an Uber on a Friday night, your prices go up. If Taylor Swift is coming out or Oasis that came out this year, then they push the prices up too. But this is en masse. So personalized pricing is a little bit more creepy in that it's just for you. It knows exactly or not exactly. It guesses how much you're willing to pay and it charges that amount.
What kind of information am I giving it? How does it know what I'm willing to pay?
Well, this is based on your personal browsing history. And you mentioned you in the promo, you said, I've clicked on the cart, it's looked at my browsing history. It can look through a whole range of data that you have online, how long you've hovered on a particular image, what you've bought in the past. It even knows in some instances some level of income you're in based on your postcode. So it really tracks a whole range of data that can inform what they give the price. And with AI coming, my gosh, this is the precipice, right, of the data that you've been actually browsing actually becomes stored history that a firm has on you and that it can use to either your advantage or your disadvantage.
So you say we're on the precipice, but am I right in thinking it's probably already happening?
It is already happening, but not on the supermarket shelves. I imagine once you've got a digitalized price on the shelf that adjusts as you come along. Anything with online commerce can be, and it really depends about the depth of data that the company has on you. And I'm assuming the larger the company, the more that they have data on you as well. Look, it's interesting because I did an interview on this last week with Qantas, and they said they're not doing this. But then the question is, how do we know that they're not doing it? And I suppose it requires a little bit of forensic investigation, to find out whether it is happening to you. It does feel like it's happening. I bought an airfare last week, and it went up $1,000 in the time that I had. So I've experienced this personally, and it does feel a little predatory.
I've definitely seen the thing where I look at something and then I get an email later saying 10% off, basically to sweeten the deal to get you to actually check out, to the point where I also almost don't want to buy something straight away in case it's one of those companies that's doing this thing. Is there a way that we can kind of game the system here?
Well, I think there is. So you can clear your cache, right? So if it's based on your browsing history and it's popping up with one price, you could clear your browsing history so it can't look at that. Basically you could change your VPN so it doesn't know your location. But then that's only for very savvy people, right? That's for people that are really aware of their circumstances. They're not relying on you being savvy. They're relying on you responding to those immediate calls to action. Like you said, 10% now. We get these pop-ups already saying there's only three left here. And, that is based on the idea of scarcity, that you might miss out. And we don't want FOMO, particularly if it's an event or it's accommodation. So we tend to respond to that. So my feeling is that you have to be almost one step ahead of those companies so that they don't have this data on you. But the problem is we live so much online now. Our digital footprint would scare you if you knew how much they had on you and how deep it was. So how do you get ahead in this? I think you check with alternate people, you check other browsers, but the problem, particularly if you've got something like airlines, is ostensibly we only have two domestic airlines in Australia. So there's not that much competition. The more competition you have, the better. Where it becomes a little bit suspicious is around points like insurance agencies that you can potentially use that data. If it becomes to healthcare, I think that becomes really concerning as well. So I think at some point there's going to be needing to be a little bit more regulation here.
Yeah. What kind of regulation do you think would be necessary to keep this fair?
Well, in Europe, they are actually a little bit more on top of this. So the GDPR over there means that, and you will understand this if you've gone onto any European site, it asks you whether you accept or reject the cookies. In Australia, we're not doing that just yet. Australian sites don't always ask you to accept or reject the cookies. So you can, there is an opportunity that you could potentially reject the cookies. There's also probably more steps that could be done around, I think within places like California, about their privacy laws and how much consumers get control over their data, which kind of indirectly limits how much they can personalise that pricing. And hopefully, I know with the supermarket inquiry that came out last year, there was a push to give more power to the ACCC to look at this pricing discrimination. So I think that potentially we want to be able to remain anonymous, but that requires us to forego a little bit of convenience. Mm. Often if you click on through those, I reject the cookies, you have to click through a few more, there's a few more boxes you have to tick rather than just accept, and that takes it through the browser. But in the long run, I think that gives us more power as consumers. And as an economist, I'm happy to have for for consumers to have more power.
What are your tips for people if they do want to be savvy consumers here, but still retain some of that convenience you were talking about?
Well, the first thing is to clear your history and clear your cache before you make any major purchases. Now, that is a little inconvenient sometimes. Again, this is not always about convenience. Sometimes, now, this doesn't always work, is to go on that incognito mode, the private browsing mode. You could try a different device. So you could go on a laptop, on a phone, use your partner's device or another family member's device. And maybe you could also use a VPN so you can appear in a different location, but that probably is for the more savvy people. And also the other thing is probably not to create an account until you're ready to buy. Because once you create the account, they immediately have that information on you. So maybe just hold off a little bit while you're browsing. And because the more you're logged in and they're watching you, they actually have more data on you. Always check across platforms as well.
On the text line, Dean says, I can see poor people being hired by rich people to buy for them. Meg, it's a little bit of a grim future you've painted for us here, but thank you very much anyway.
Thank you so much, Tegan.
Soon-to-be Associate Professor Meg Elkins is a behavioural economist at RMIT. Across the country, there are about 45,000 kids in out-of-home care. About 8,000 of them are in a foster care home. And as we were discussing earlier in the show, in Victoria, some foster carers are reporting sudden reductions in their allowances for looking after kids with high-level needs. Your texts really drove home this morning just how many challenges there are when it comes to finding foster carers for kids who need safe and stable homes. And you also heard from Emma, who's a foster carer in Brisbane. She says a broken system has her seriously considering if she fosters another child. Here's a bit of what she said to me earlier.
We are definitely. Our care renewal is up in 3 months' time. I think over the last 5 years we've had some beautiful cases. We've had some cases that are just, you want to bash your head against a brick wall. You feel unappreciated. You feel used. There's no continuity within the department and the people that you deal with. So, you feel like no one knows these kids. And as carers, you become the advocate for them and you become their voices. But your voice is not heard. Your opinion is irrelevant. So, I feel like you're fighting a broken system. And I don't know if it's easier to walk away from that, or I don't know if it's, something that you just want to keep picking at. And I believe you can't complain about a situation if you're not prepared to change it. So, as carers, we're sitting there going, look, emotionally and morally, we really want to do this, but, the emotional toll that it has on yourself and also your kids. And I think that when you've got your own children and you do become a carer, your children are, they're undervalued, they're overlooked, and they are such an important part of the system, because they are the ones that are showing these kids like some normality in society. They're the ones that, share their home, they open up their rooms, they, share their toys, they play games with them, they're such a huge part. And the department, I don't know, they're so unappreciative, and I think they could do better in the support for families. So, I think that we've just experienced so many times that it's like our kids are left in emotional, that emotionally they don't cope when placements move on and there's no support for them. So I think the bigger picture is not only as adults wanting to make that difference, but the impact that it has on your family and, whether or not time will fix that, have a year off and then go back to it. But I don't know, it's a tricky one, Tegan.
That was foster carer Emma speaking to me earlier in the show. You can catch up on all of our stories, including the rest of that, on the ABC Listen app. That is almost it for Life Matters, coming to you today from Jagera and Turrbal Land. Tomorrow on the show, you get to hear a chat that I had with Wikipedia founder Jimmy Wales, talking about a commodity he says is under serious threat at the moment, trust. We talked about so many of the things that I talk about with you all the time, what AI means for the way we live, tricky work relationships, and yes, trust, what running one of the world's top websites as a nonprofit has taught him about building and keeping trust. So make sure you tune into Life Matters tomorrow for that conversation, and I'll catch you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.